When Genesis was written by Moses about 1450 B.C., the Holy Spirit had him set down some fundamental concepts for the nation of Israel, concepts that were unique in comparison to idolatry and certainly different from the concepts that they had been surrounded by for the last several hundred years as they were in Egypt. And so it starts out with maybe what we could say is the most fundamental concept, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created. God as the creator of the universe then has ultimate power and authority over all things He created. And He is indeed the judge of all the earth. As you read through Genesis 1 about the creation of the birds, the creation of the fish, the creation of the land animals. It's not until you get to verse 26 that there's something very unique about the thing He creates there. Not said about any other of the multiplied thousands of things that God created. And that is that God made man in His image. And as you read verse 26 and 27, you see that that was intended to be applied without gender differing in gender. That is, it's for male and female. And so both man and woman are made in the image of God. The human being is made in the image of God. That is a fundamental concept. And it is one that does affect, as we prayed about it a moment ago with Wally, our attitude toward ourself, and then our attitude toward our neighbor. That being true, and the fact that the second greatest commandment is love your neighbor as yourself, then understanding what it means that God made man in His image takes on a very important role. And so that's what we've been studying in these last few lessons. What does it mean when it says God made man in His own image? Now, in our last class, we discussed the fact of something it does not mean, and that is it does not refer to a physical image. And so while the Bible talks about God having hands and eyes and ears, that's not saying that God looks like a man and we were made in His image physically. We noted in our lesson, God is also said to have wings, for example. He's sometimes called a fountain of living water. These are figurative expressions. And we've studied the fact that God is a spirit being, and a spirit being doesn't have flesh and bones. So, what does God look like? We'd have no idea about that. He's a spirit being. But yet we're said to be made in His image. How is that so? We're not going to look at the positive side of that tonight unless we have time toward the end of our lesson. But we're going to look at another couple of misconceptions about that to disabuse our minds of some concepts that may lead us down a path that are not correct. So the first one that you have in your lesson is, man is not in the image of God in his character, that is, in his thinking and conduct. One of the dangers in studying the Bible is finding the term image and applying it across the board wherever you may see it. Any word like that. You know, in our last lesson, if you still have a copy of that last lesson, we talked about this very thing right at the beginning of the lesson. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 9, he talks about laying aside the old self, putting on the new self that's renewed in the true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. While you do not have it on your lesson, I believe it was Herb that made mention of Romans chapter 8. Where there he talked about verse 29. He predestined His people to be conformed to the image of His Son. Just, I think it was a few weeks ago, it may have been months, I heard a sermon by a gospel preacher, and he's a good man, good preacher. But he took Romans 8 text and then went back to Genesis 1. God made man His image, but he lost that image. And now we've got to be renewed to the image of God. Sounds good. Probably when he stood in the back after the sermon, he had people telling him what a great lesson it was. And he had some good points. But if I'm correct, and I could be wrong, that is an incorrect association of passages and words. And so we'll see some of that tonight. In fact, we'll start with Genesis 9:6. A key passage in this whole discussion. Genesis 1 lays the foundation that man and woman was made in God's image. After Noah came out of the ark, here are laws that's to govern humankind, regardless of race, gender, culture, whatever, universal law. And so we have this verse 6, and we have the question on the lesson for tonight. Is it okay to murder a sinner?
No.
I hope everybody put no. The next question, why not? Here's a guy who's despicable. You know, he's a blight on society. Maybe he's a drunkard and abuses his family. Maybe he's a bum, and so he's a burden on welfare, and he steals from people. He busts out the window of your car so he can get your stuff. Uses profanity and vile language. Maybe he exposes himself publicly. I mean, he's just sorry guy, and he's bad effect on society. He costs you money. Because he drinks, he's a danger to you when you get on the road. Why not just take the guy out? What is society going to lose? What's wrong with that? What? Made in the image of God. That's exactly right. I don't have it on the lesson. But a parallel question could be this. Let's suppose he's not such a morally bad guy. But due to an accident or birth defects or injury, he's a burden on society, he's a burden on his family. Maybe he doesn't have his mental capacity like he once had, or maybe never had. Maybe he doesn't have the ability, the physical ability to care for himself. There's nothing he's going to be able to do productive in society. He's in pain. Let's kill him. You won't have to pay welfare for him. Somebody won't have to be constantly taking care of him. If not, why not? Where is that about having a soul? What verse is that? Can you give me a verse? Why not kill him? That's it. Same answer. He's made in the image of God. And that does have to do with the soul. But that text says, we're going to talk about the soul in our next class. But he's made in the image of God. That's why. Is there anybody that advocates that concept today? Oh, yes. In fact, it's not uncommon to hear those who adopt the philosophy of humanism to say if a child is born defective in some way, kill it. that's the way to go. That's what you do with a horse that's got a broken leg. And of course, that's the product of evolution. The idea that we've all evolved and we're just a higher form of animal. If your children are in school, we've got a teacher here tonight. Glad to have her visiting with us. But in school, young people may be asked this question: are you animal, vegetable, or mineral? What kind of answer do they want?
Animal
is what they want. And so they're taught that they're animal. And of course, if you have children that may face that, teach them the right answer for school, but teach them also that that's not true. Maybe they write the teacher a note on the side. Here's the answer you want, but it's incorrect. But anyway, yes, sir.
Steve, you're talking about this person who take his life because he can't take care of himself. But what about this person who wants to take his own life? He wants to have euthanasia. The state of Oregon, I think they allow doctors to perform euthanasia.
Yeah. Good question. So suicide. What about committing suicide because you're in pain? And it's a whole different study, the subject of suicide, but unless I missed it, it's the same thing. I made the image of God, and I don't have that right. I don't have that liberty. I am not just mine. I belong to God. I'm made in His image. And I do not have the right to take my own life. Okay, so good question, Rocky. Now, as you look at this verse, when you think about people being despicable, and it's got to be careful about the word hate. You hate what they do. There's a right way that the Bible talks about hating a sinner. But be that as it may, turn to 1 Samuel 25. I'm not going to read verse 2 through 13. It's a story you're familiar with about David and Nabal. And you do read in verse 2 that this guy was very rich. Nabal was very rich. And you also see that David was in the wilderness with his army. He knew that Nabal had plenty of means to help feed his army, and David and his army had provided him protection. And so he sends and requests that they might give them some sustenance. But in verse 10, Nabal responds, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread, my water, and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" So, first of all, what has he done? What sin has he committed toward David right out of the box?
Love thy neighbor.
What?
Love thy neighbor.
Okay, love thy neighbor. Can you be more specific? What has he done to David by accusing him of breaking away from his master?
Slander.
That's slander, isn't it? Saul wanted to kill him. It's not about David, "I don't want to serve Saul. I'm going to go over here and get me an army and take the throne." It's not that kind of thing. And so that's the first thing. And then, of course, the man is selfish, and he's very smart-aleck is what we call it. But then down when you get down to verse 17, one of the young men who heard what happened came and told Abigail about it. And it's interesting, some of his own people who worked for him, here's how they describe it at the end of verse 17. "He's such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Nice guy, they say, Nabal. Such a worthless man, nobody can speak to him. His own wife, an intelligent woman, when she talks about him, note down in verse 25, she said, "Do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name, so is he." Nabal, which means a fool. She says, Nabal is his name and folly is with him. That's what he is. He's a fool. He's well named. And so that's not a very high recommendation. Apparently a sorry guy, somebody you don't want to be around. And so what does David decide he's going to do? He's going to kill him. Would it have been a loss to society? I guess a lot of people would have thrown a party. But Abigail intercepts David, as you recall, and it's interesting to see what she said in verse 31. Look at verse 31, because this is going to deal with this next question I have. She said, "This will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself." So, back in Genesis 9, if you want to go hold your finger there, go back to Genesis 9 again. I asked the question, is it okay to murder a sinner? And you answered correctly, no. And yet, this particular verse says that if this sinner himself is a murderer, men are to kill him. Look, it says, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed." So while the verse prohibits murder, it requires men putting men to death. How do we reconcile that?
Governing authority.
Sir? Governing authority. Governing authority? Explain, Mark. Explain what you mean.
Well, in Romans 12, it talks about God ordains the powers of be. And it mentions, it says that they're not there in vain, they do not bear the sword in vain. Of course, the sword is symbolic of punishment all the way to the ministering death.
All right. That's a good point we're going to get to in a minute. Were there any governing authorities at this time?
Not stated.
Huh? They just come out of the flood, out of the ark. What'd you say, Sally?
Well, I said David was the governing authority. Talking about.
Look at Numbers 35. Numbers 35. Verse 16 through 18 talks about if a fellow kills another man, struck him with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. Struck him down with a stone, etc. He's a murderer. Same thing in 18. Struck him with a wooden object. All right, now 19. The blood avenger himself shall surely put the murderer to death. Is that a governing authority? You know what that is? That's a relative. A relative? Yeah. So he's to put the murderer to death. Is that murder? It's authorized by God. That's the difference. God authorized, not only authorized, required that murderers be put to death. Now later, as Mark points out in Romans 13, there were governing authorities to do that. But we're here back under the Old Testament. Here they are in the wilderness. What governing authority? You know? So there's a blood avenger. But you'll note, verse 20, if he pushed him of hatred. Here's the difference in murder and killing. Here's this guy who's murdered somebody. You put him to death. But murder proceeds out of either passion or personal vengeance or a personal agenda that disregards human life. In other words, part of a gang initiation, or people do it for fun, or whatever. That's murder. Here, he mentions hatred. So what's to be done with this guy? Then he says he put to death, he's a murderer. But look at verse 22, the difference. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, That's different. That's not premeditated murder. See, there's a difference. And so in that particular case, he could go to the city of refuge and be protected if he'd stay there. And so God made a difference in killing and murder. Our Bibles, especially the King James Version, uses the word kill, thou shalt not kill. That's not wrong, but the word kill is a word, one of those buses that has a number of different passengers on it. God doesn't forbid killing. In fact, He requires killing. But when that killing is out of disregard for the fact that man's made in the image of God, I don't have the right to take his life unless God authorizes it. And even if God authorizes it, I have the right, I believe, if they still use the electric chair, and there's a man that's been sentenced to death, to pull the switch. But if that fella had done something to my family, I might have a hard time doing it. Why? Do it out of revenge. That's not allowed. So that's what you find in 1 Samuel 26. David killed people. He was a general. He was a military man. But this woman had discernment. She says, you're on a wrong mission. You just want to avenge yourself. It's a personal issue. And David commended her for her discernment, verse 33, and kept him from blood shed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Very enlightening passages. And underlying it all is the idea of man is made in the image of God. We are not our own. We belong to Him. He has the right to say if we live or die. He has the right to tell others to take our life. Look at, Mark's already mentioned Romans 13. Look at Acts 25:11. Paul said, if I'm a wrongdoer, what? If I've committed anything worthy of death, what? I'm going to get me a good lawyer? I'm an apostle. I shouldn't die. Is that what he said?
He wants the law to be adhered to.
Sir?
He wants the law to be adhered to.
Wants the law to what?
Be adhered to. Follow.
That in this verse?
No.
Oh.
It says, I do not refuse to die. But
I do not refuse to die. So that's what it is referring to. I do not refuse to die. Follow the law. That's a good point, isn't it? I do not refuse to die. He recognizes the right of capital punishment, thing Mark was talking about. And so we need to make that distinction. And it goes back to the basic thing we've been talking about, man made in the image of God. Any other comments before we go to our next verse? Yes, ma'am.
As far as capital punishment, obviously we go by what's the governing authorities now. Is as far as authority from God, is murder the only cause of capital punishment?
It wasn't under the Old Testament.
Right.
And unfortunately, our laws are much looser. But kidnapping, a number of things were cause for even abusing your parents. But we don't live under those laws. Yes, Rocky?
On Genesis 9:6, I guess it's important to note that applies to all people, all dispensations, the universal law.
Good point that Rocky makes. It's universal law. There was no Jewish nation at that time. This is not a Jewish law. It's a universal law for mankind. Unfortunately, men don't recognize God in His laws. That's a good point. Sir? Where at?
Would it be revenge or not? in the Old Testament, when it's talking about if two men, I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember exactly where it's at. If two men were in a fight, and because of them fighting, they strike a pregnant woman and she loses the child, there was authority to avenge that child.
That's right.
The unborn child. How would that not be revenge?
It's not for you to do it. It's for the judges to do it, to legislate that and that person to be put to death. Far as I know, God does not allow you to take life out of personal vengeance. David took life right and left, but he wasn't allowed to do it out of personal vengeance. And so I think that would be an issue you'd have to weigh. That's like fighting in the army. It may not be wrong to kill, but are you doing it out of personal vengeance or pride? And that's a question that every soldier has to ask. Griselda's here tonight, and of course Pete's a policeman. Can Pete shoot somebody and kill him? Yes. We've got people here in the audience. I'm sure it's packing tonight. Can they shoot somebody? Yes. But it can't be an act of personal vengeance. All right, James chapter 3 and verse 9. Talking about the tongue. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men. Why should we not curse men, even evil men? Why? Made in the likeness of God. But they're aggravating. They've hurt you. They've done things wrong. Maybe they divided the church. He's talking here about teachers who in their pride would form parties. But he said you can't use your tongue that way. And this is particularly talking about tongues of teachers. How they might use their tongues that way. Now, cursing and cussing are not necessarily the same thing. To cuss, as we use it, C-U-S-S, usually connotes the idea of using profanity. Some obscene, maybe lewd language. That idea. But you can curse and not use profanity. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 16. Look at verse 5. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing. Now, no, not cussing. Cursing. Continually as he came. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. Thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. Note the next statement. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. King said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Not sure David's correct about that. In fact, when Solomon became king. If you'll go over to 1 Kings. First Kings chapter 2, verse 8. David's about to die. He's preparing his son Solomon to take the throne. Verse 8. Behold, there is with you Shimei, the son of Jehu, the Benjamite of Bahurim. Now it is he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day I went to Mahanaim. When he came down to me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. That's a little bit later in 2 Samuel, I think 18. Now therefore, do not let him go unpunished, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do, and you'll bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. And so you can read about what he did with Shimei in the next chapter, how he told him if he stayed in Jerusalem, he'd let him live. Shimei didn't, and so he put him to death. And all of that had to do with the idea of confirming Solomon's rule and dominion as king. He was a young man, maybe not even 20. But be that as it may, Shimei cursed David. And so when you get later in 2 Samuel, you'll see that it's the idea of not wishing him good, wishing that Absalom would overthrow him. And that's what cursing is to wish evil on somebody. And a person can curse someone and never use a profane or dirty word, as we say, or a vulgar word. And so just be aware of what James 3 is warning us about. Man is made in the likeness of God. That demands that we do what to him? What?
Seek his good.
Seek his good. What's one word for seek his good?
Love.
You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Seek his good is an excellent definition. That's what it is. You seek his good. You love him. And it's based on respect. Not because he's a good guy. Not because he's a great character. But because he's in the likeness of God. So behind all of that is this reverence for God. Obviously, if you don't have any reverence for God, all of that is absolutely meaningless. So it starts out with a reverence for God, where these things, these kind of laws would have any kind of teeth whatsoever. All right, so man is in the image of God, but not in character, not in thinking and conduct. It is true, Romans 8, Colossians 3 talks about us developing an image like God. But that's a character imposed upon this basic thing that we have because we're made a certain way. It's about our moral and spiritual makeup and not what Genesis 1 is talking about, unless I've missed it. So just be careful when you see image. You know, Christ is in the image of God. We talked about that last lesson. Nobody's in the image of God like he is. Talk about his divine nature. Yes, sir?
It's logical thinking about this is if we were made in the image of God in terms of character, would we not be sinless?
Would we not be what?
Sinless.
Rocky's got a good point. If we were made in the image of God character-wise, we would have no sin. But, of course, what the way the sermon goes is we lost that image when we sin. Well, if we lost that image, can people kill you? Can they? Sure. You're not in the image of God anymore. If that's what that's talking about. Isn't that a consequence? So you got to be careful where your thinking takes you on this, you see. Okay. All right. So, made in the image of God, not the lower part of man in common with the animal kingdom. So let's go to Genesis 7. What does man have in common with the animal kingdom according to this verse? What? I can't argue with the answer, but that's not what I'm looking for. Wally said they die. Well, that's right. Okay, I guess I need to be more specific on my question. What I'm looking for here in verse 21, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life, died. Animals have the breath of the Spirit of life. And so, earlier Ennis talked about the soul. That's a good term, but there's a sense in which animals have, quote unquote, a soul. It's not the same thing as when we talk about a man. But that word, in fact, if you're talking to a materialist like a Jehovah's Witness, they'll turn to these verses and say, see, man and animal have the same thing. Because the Hebrew word is used both of man and animals. And so don't worry about the Hebrew. Just use the context. What about Genesis 1? What about Genesis 9? What about James 3? And so you don't have to be a Hebrew scholar for all of that. Yes, there is some commonality between man and animals. But Genesis 1 said there's also a drastic difference. What is it? Genesis 1, 26 and 27. What is the difference? Man's made in the image of God. That's the difference. And so you don't have to be a Hebrew scholar to know that. And that's peculiarly said of man. And then we read Genesis 9, 1 through 6. And let's just go back there again. We've referred to that several times, but go back with me again to Genesis 9. No, depending on what you mean by soul. I'm just saying what's going to happen if you use the word soul. You're not incorrect. The New Testament talks about man and his soul. What will man give in exchange for his soul, in that sense, or life? I'm just saying to be aware that if you're talking to a JW, for example, they'll say, look here, this Old Testament Hebrew word is used also of animals. Now what? So I want a passage. I don't have to know Hebrew. Here's Genesis 1, Genesis 9. Clearly makes a difference based on what? Image of God. Yeah, no, you're not wrong about that, Ennis. It's exactly right. Just, and I imagine most of the people you talk to know exactly what you're talking about. So that's a good distinction. As far as understanding the difference, unless they've been educated in materialistic thinking. So I don't mean to imply at all that that's a wrong way to respond. Here we see in verse 2 the clear distinction in the fact that the fear and terror of you will be on every beast of the field, every bird of the sky, everything that creeps on the ground. So is it okay to be a Christian and be a hunter?
Yes.
Sure. And there are people today that act like hunting is terrible. And yet here you see you can kill these animals for food. He said it's just like the plant, verse 3. So can you tear the plant out of the ground and put it in the stove and cook it? Sure. And you can do that with animals because, as I put on the lesson, man is not an animal. He's not an animal. God makes that difference. Now, this is probably a good spot. Well, I timed this perfect. See, we're almost out of time. I joke about cats, okay? But I want you to understand that those are jokes. I don't want to leave the impression the Bible says it's okay to be cruel to animals. Any animal. Even a cat. look at some verses here with me. Look at Proverbs 12:10. A righteous man has regard for the life of his animal. The compassion of the wicked is cruel. So here's a general statement of wisdom, that a righteous man has some idea of compassion, regard, compassion, second line, for his animal. Look at Numbers 22. Number 22, verse 30. This is the story of Balaam and his donkey. So the donkey talks, verse 30. Am I not your donkey on which you've ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you? In other words, is this right the way you're treating me? You want to kill me because I'm doing what I'm doing? And he's not even under the donkey's control. That's a pretty smart donkey to reason all that out and talk, wouldn't it?
It was a donkey. It was truly talking.
It was God, wasn't it? Holy Spirit enabling that donkey to talk. But look at the lesson in it. The appeal. I've never treated you badly. Why are you doing this? I find that interesting. You say, you mean God makes laws for animals? Yes. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 25. And verse 4. You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. Now Paul pointed out in 1 Corinthians 9 that wasn't just written for oxen's sake. But it was partially to teach men about the way that they should treat their oxen who are working for them. And there's one more interesting statement before we close our class. I didn't get to the last point, did I? Oh, well. Read Jonah 4:11. God talked about not only the people there, but the animals. Real quickly, look at Genesis 1. We'll close our class. Verse 26 and 27. Was man in the image of God because he was given dominion over all the earth? I asked the question, was man created in the image of God, or did he gain that after he was created? He was created in the image of God, wasn't he? But yet, verse 26, let us make man in our image, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, etc. So God created man in his own image. Then verse 28, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. So the dominion followed the creation, and his being in the image of God is not his dominion over fish and birds and fowl and animals and the earth, if I understand the passage. All right, our time is up. Lord willing, next class we'll start on a positive now note. We've talked about what it doesn't mean. We'll talk about what it does mean. And we'll be able to talk more about Ennis's good comments about our soul in that lesson. So, the next class will be next Wednesday, not Sunday, because we've got our gospel meeting. So next Wednesday. Okay? Thank you.